We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. We are going to be continuing this week with our year-end extravaganza.
Because it is the end of the year, actually.
It is. It apparently is. And anyone knows where it went, feel free to email in. But we'll begin to that in just a minute. We're going to start out with a couple local stories.
Yeah, we did local overhyped and underreported last week. We'll do national this week. And then next week for our grand finale, we'll do international and head on into 2014.
All right. So first, a couple not overhyped or underreported local stories, starting with $15 an hour.
Yes. Ed Murray, our new mayor, elect Ed Murray, because he hasn't been sworn in yet, announced this week that he was putting together a task force to study the $15 an hour minimum wage. This came a few days after new city council member Shama Sawant, who usually is announced as new socialist city council member Shama Sawant.
Yes, and she's also a member-elect. She hasn't been sworn in yet either.
Yes, and she also has not been sworn in yet. Had made an announcement that she wanted the city to move forward on a $15 an hour minimum wage, and if the mayor and city council didn't get cracking and do something, that she would push to get an initiative on the ballot.
And in fact, there's a new organization that started this week toward that effect called 15 Now. And that in part also is what Murray was responding to.
Yeah. And so Murray was sort of got a fire lit under him. He met with Sawant this week and he put together this idea of a task force. Excuse me. Now, a lot of what we hear about it in the news is that, oh, it has this, you know, this socialist who sits on the council. I'm getting a little tired of that being the only newsworthy thing about the $15 an hour minimum wage. What I saw rather newsworthy in the task force is that, yes, it does have Sawant sitting on it, but it also has a lot of the usual suspects, including some one or two of the richest people in the city of Seattle, as well as some other major business owners who are part of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce.
You know what it does not have on it? It doesn't have anybody who actually makes a minimum wage salary on it.
Yeah, which is very interesting, I think. Given that a lot of the folks who sit on this council, you look at their incomes and you think these people are making several hundred dollars an hour. Asking for $15 is pretty minimal. I wonder why these folks are even sitting on that panel, but you know.
That reason. That question answers itself.
Yeah, I think that ought to be the newsworthy aspect here.
So no high hopes for what's coming out of this panel?
Well, we'll see. Sawant said that that she was part of the panel to see if she could move the process forward, to try to move the process forward. If it doesn't move forward, I think she's serious. And as Jav said, there's already a group that's formed to put the initiative on the ballot to make it a reality.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
Okay. A judge coming out with some use of force guidance?
Yes. Judge Robart, who is the judge that's been overseeing the implementation of the agreement between the Department of Justice and the Seattle Police Department to reform the Seattle Police Department, he okayed a new use of force policy that the Seattle Police Department will be following. This use of force policy was negotiated between the Seattle Police Department, the Department of Justice, the monitor in the court-appointed monitor of the SPD reform, and a group that was formed under the agreement that was meant to include citizens to review these new kinds of changes in the Seattle Police Department. One of the great things I think about the use of force policy is that it replaces the old use of force policy, which was, you know, all of 5 pages long, and it actually defines use of force for the first time so that certain Seattle members of the Seattle Police Department who weren't clear about what that meant in the past can now be fairly clear about what it means. It means any physical coercion by an officer in the performance of their duties. So that's fairly clear. And I think, among other things, one of the best aspects of this new use of force policy is that it says that police have to first attempt to de-escalate tense situations before they use force. They have to use a number of different techniques, including verbal de-escalation. And it also requires new reporting guidelines that all uses of force, except the most minimal, have to be reported by the officers. And it creates a new force investigation team to look into all uses of force by police, yeah, which they didn't have in the past.
Yeah, it is definitely an improvement. One of the things that it does not address, however, is the problem of police lying. And that came up again this week when we had the second lawsuit that had been announced coming out of the police arrest from the May Day, quote-unquote, riots in 2012, those riots, of course, being primarily law enforcement riots, not protester riots. This followed by a photographer who was charged with assaulting an officer and then apprehended very, very, very roughly. Lo and behold, there's video, which led to the charges being dropped, that he never went anywhere near the officer and did not touch him. But, again, that claim was used in order to justify the force. And this sort of thing, as anybody who has been to a protest that has had arrest knows, this sort of thing happens routinely in protests where, you know, the running joke about assaulting an officer's fist with your face. You know, again, if there is not goodwill and a culture of wanting to use force as a last rather than a first result within the police department, the guidelines are helpful, but there's still gonna be problems.
Yeah, and you know, the guidelines do specify now that it is inappropriate, that officers should not use force to retaliate against people. Or for dealing with people who verbally confront an officer, which has been one of the big issues in the past, particularly demonstrations, when activists go up and say, "Hey, stop beating that man," then they often get force used against them as well.
Yeah, because they're very sensitive souls, and being told to stop beating somebody is, you know, kind of traumatizing.
Yes.
All right. Poor guys.
Moving on, Eastside Catholic.
Yeah, interesting. Saw an article on this in Al Jazeera today, so it's gone international. The protests yesterday, a sit-in and public protest, rather Thursday, a sit-in and public protest, and then yesterday down by the Seattle Archdiocese. But stemming from Eastside Catholic School in Sammamish, deciding earlier this week to fire Vice Principal there, who he was forced to resign because this past summer he married his same-sex partner. The school has faculty members sign a contract vowing to follow the church's doctrine, which of course includes homosexuality is a sin, et cetera, et cetera. The interesting part about this is that the school principal, and this is not something that was widely reported, said that it was the archdiocese that ordered the school to do it. And remember, this is an archdiocese headed by Archbishop J. Peter Sartain, who actively campaigned and forced parishes in the archdiocese to campaign against Referendum 74, when it was a same-sex marriage referendum, when it was on the ballot in 2010. Also the archbishop, by the way, who left his previous post in 2010 in Illinois to come out here with accusations that he had covered up a pedophilic priest, and not only covered that up, but promoted the guy. So, you know, apparently it's a bad thing to marry a consenting adult, but it's, you know, okay if it's a minor. Something.
This also has some pretty bad. This also has some pretty bad implications for the hospitals that are being purchased by Catholic agencies too, where patients are worried that they will not be allowed to have certain family planning services because, you know, that's the policy of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, not to mention, you know, respecting the ability of spouses to visit when you have a seriously ill spouse in there who happens to be of the same sex.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing about this that was not widely reported was that on Thursday, when students were rallying outside the school, the fired vice principal, a guy named Mark Zamuda, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, came out and spoke to the students. And I want to quote one of the things that he was quoted in the YouTube of this as saying, because I think it shows some of the dynamic here. Quote, I think a lot of you guys are raising a generation that is more open and acceptable to things that are legal now in the state of Washington, but I just want to let you know that my personal life is a small part of who I am. I am first a teacher and administrator, and I try my best to be an educator to each and every one of you. And I hope that no matter what happens to me and to the school, that all of you guys will seek a career and work very hard, find the love of your life, hopefully one day get married as well. At the same time, no matter what happens, strive to do your best. That is class, and that is called using a teachable moment. And both Zamuda and the students in this case showing far more class and far more behavior, far more worthy of emulation than anything the so-called moral authorities of the church have demonstrated this week.
Yes.
All right. So the kids are all right.
Excellent. Let's move on then to the national overhyped and underreported stories.
Yeah. Last week we did the local overhyped and underreported stories of the year, and this week we want to look at national. I didn't have that many overhyped stories, although the ones I did have are going to be really familiar to everybody. For example, the Republican mantra that Americans want government to go away. That's on the top of my list. When in fact, really, I think what Americans want is for politicians who don't do their jobs and don't manage to get anything done to go away.
Yeah, and we saw with the public polling and the government shutdown that guess what? That in fact is not what the vast, vast majority of Americans want. There was a bunch of stuff around the Republicans this year that was overhyped, primarily because we have a media system that uses false equivalents a lot and uses stenography a lot without applying any litmus tests of, oh, is this reality based, for example. So that you had about this time last year, this whole PR campaign by Republican Party leadership at the national level that, we've learned the lessons of the presidential election in 2012, and we're going to moderate, and we recognize that we can't really win national elections at this point without doing a better job with women and minorities. So we're going to try and make the party more acceptable to them. Well, of course, what that meant was we need to try and have a different marketing campaign because our messaging isn't working. It's not like any of our policies might, for example, actually be hostile to women or minorities. And as it turns out, that didn't even work very well because, you know, the Republican Party is chock full of people who keep saying racist, sexist things and proposing racist, sexist legislation. So that didn't work very well. And then we had all year long just one after another of these fake scandals involving Obama, basically because they can't stand Obama, and therefore anything he does by definition is a scandal. So anything from Benghazi.
And I think it's also an aspect of the racism of the Republican Party.
I was going there.
Any African-American person who was not a Republican from the far right, like Clarence Thomas, for example, would have been a target of the Republican Party.
Yeah. So we had everything basically from Benghazi to selfies and everything in between. But there was one in particular that showed just how dysfunctional the media coverage is, which was the IRS scandal, if you remember this, where the IRS is going after Tea Party organizations. Well, as it turns out, and we didn't learn the whole story about this until several months later, not only was the IRS investigating 501c4s that were explicitly political in contradiction to IRS guidelines, and they should have, in fact, not honored the tax exemption applications of a number of these, although in fact they did in almost every case, and that was the real scandal. But it turns out they're investigating all 501c4 applications, not just those of conservatives.
As they should.
As they should. But the reason it was played out that way was Daryl Issa, who is the Tea Party head of the Government Oversight Committee in the House of Representatives, leaked selectively to the national media that the IRS was targeting Tea Party ones when he knew for a fact that they were targeting all 501c4s, and without looking at all at the actual claim or looking at even the source documents that Issa had, they went ahead and ran with the story. And it took months for that story to be undone. And of course, you still have a credulous Tea Party nation who thinks this was a thing. This is the kind of thing that happens over and over again, where the claims just aren't being investigated or given any kind of scrutiny.
Yeah, and I had two other things on my list of overhyped stories. One was as far as the economy is concerned, the biggest overhype story was the federal, another federal mantra of how the huge federal government deficit is going to drive the country into bankruptcy, like happened to these small countries in Europe. That's not only overhyped, it is patently divorced from reality. The federal deficit is getting smaller all the time with the uptick in the economy and the fact that interest rates are at historic lows, and for various other reasons, including the sequestration. So the federal government deficit is really not an issue at all.
That's also apples to oranges because the countries in question in Europe don't issue their own currency.
Yeah, they're not on a par at all with the United States government. And then the other overhyped story on my list is folks might remember from early this year the phrase "Cyber Pearl Harbor," which I laughed at when I heard it. Because, in fact, if you want to know the truth, we have brought Cyber Pearl Harbor to countries like Iran and other nations of the world with our own cyber attacks.
Yeah, it's like Pearl Harbor happened 5 or 6 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I had a couple other quick overhyped ones also. The 2016 presidential race, just stop. Just don't. And then also the Boston Marathon bombing, which was a tremendous amount of attention given to a crime that turned out to be an isolated crime committed by a couple of allegedly committed by a couple of pretty disturbed individuals that didn't actually kill all that many people, even in comparison to another event which happened the same week, which was the fertilizer plant explosion in Waco, Texas, which was specifically a reaction to an almost inevitable reaction to government deregulation and a corporation that ignored safety regulations in search of profits. Those folks were in many ways intentionally killed as well, and yet that wasn't considered an act of terrorism, let alone, and it was gone.
Let alone newsworthy.
After 24 or 36 hours in the media compared to the Boston Marathon bombing that went on for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah. So let's move on to the underreported stories for National. At the top of my list is the vast expansion of the Department of Defense Cyber Command, including a first strike capability. It's apparently the replacement for the Cold War, this notion that we must make Americans terrified of the possibility of, as I said before, a cyber Pearl Harbor in order to give the federal government the permission to spend literally hundreds of billions of dollars on creating a huge cyber command whose main task will be to orchestrate cyber warfare against other nations.
Aggressive cyber warfare,
as we've been doing against Iran for, as it turns out, some 6 or 7 years.
Yeah. The top of my list, and I should probably just make it a permanent spot and talk about the number twos every year, is the complete lack of action at the federal level, not just domestically, but also in terms of international obstruction around climate change. And we'll talk about this with International next week. The climate change itself is also underreported and keeps getting worse and worse than even than we thought it was going to be. But, the lack of any meaningful action at the federal level and the lack of any momentum toward any action at the federal level is going to be looked back generations from now as sort of the crime of this generation. And yet it gets no media attention at all.
Yeah. Also on my list is a huge economic story, the big economic story of this year, which is the growing erosion of wages and wealth in the United States for the vast majority of people. There were a number of studies that highlighted that this year and just did not get a lot of airtime from the Federal Reserve study.
I had that as the disappearing middle class, and same thing, that was my number two also.
Yeah, from the Federal Reserve study of consumer finances showing that average American families had the same amount of wealth in 2010 that they had in the early 90s. To a study by the National Employment Law Project that showed that mid-wage jobs are completely disappearing, to statistics from the Census Bureau showing that the top 10% of earners in the United States took home more than half of all income in the U.S. in 2012, to statistics that show that the top 1% have captured 99% of all income gains since the recession began in 2007. There was just story after story after story just this year about growing wage inequality. And still we have the media asking, where did the $15 an hour minimum wage idea come from?
Why do they elect socialists?
would have to have been comatose not to have known where the $15 an hour minimum wage could have come from this year.
Well, which explains a lot of media.
Yes.
And not unrelated to that, also another underreported story is, which was the big banks, and in particular this year, J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America, keep settling criminal accusations for pennies on the dollar. I mean, you see the headlines that these are record multi-billion-dollar settlements, and yet they're settlements of criminal charges where people should have gone to jail for. And compared to the hundreds of billions of dollars in profits that these banks are making off the same practices, which continue to this day.
Yeah, and much of these settlements only represent a fraction of what these banks make in profits in a year.
Yeah.
So they really are literally slaps on the wrist.
Yeah. And again, this is directly related to the growing income gap, because if the rich can get even richer by stealing money from everybody else, guess what? They're going to keep doing that, and they are doing that.
Especially when the penalties are so small.
Yeah. Another underhyped story is, and of course there was plenty of attention to the symptoms of this, but the fact that the federal level now, we have a government by manufacturer crisis and nothing else is happening, that there is a political party in this country that is not only sadly divorced from reality on a lot of scores, but it is adopted as an intentional strategy preventing, where possible, the U.S. government from doing anything to actually govern the country except lurching Congress and lurching the economy and lurching the government from one contrived crisis to another. So we had the fiscal cliff at this time last year. We have extensions of the debt ceiling. We have all of the various negotiations around the budget, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Also underreported, when the Senate finally did a ground to abolishing the filibuster a couple of months ago, which is something that needed to happen a lot sooner and which is still a very limited reform compared to the scope of the problem. We saw a lot on sort of the politics behind it. We've seen very little about how that has enabled a number of government agencies, from different district and federal courts to various agencies whose heads had been refused confirmation, to actually start doing their work again.
Yeah. And then I had a couple of other economic stories as well. I had student loan debt reached a new record in 2013. It is now over $1 trillion in the United States, and it now exceeds auto loans for the first time in history. 20 and 30 year old people with student loan debt are much less likely to have any other kinds of debts, and they do a lot less consumer spending than their parents and grandparents did, which is one of the big reasons why the economy is still just limping along. Also, the rise in housing prices is being driven largely by investors, hedge funds, and real estate investment trusts buying up single family homes. That's another big change in the way the economy has been functioning. And again, that's true even for fixer-uppers. 68% of all damaged homes in the United States, that's more than two-thirds of the market, were bought by investors, and only about 19%, less than one-fifth, were bought by first-time home buyers. That's a big demographic shift.
Yeah. Also in the people making money where they shouldn't department, we have, despite a lowering crime rate, despite the loss of momentum for the war on drugs, the continuing expansion of the private prison system in the U.S., including a study last month that in a number of states, these contracts that private prison companies are signing with different states have quotas by which states and taxpayers in those states have to pay out to the private prison companies if the prisons are not filled to a certain level. And that can be anything from 70 up to, in some cases in places like Arizona, Oklahoma, 100% capacity, that the prisons have to be filled and people have to be making money off of warehousing other human beings, or taxpayers pay.
Yeah.
That is just a staggering indictment of where our economy has gone, and the emphasis that has been placed on profit over people.
Yeah. And then I have three that are linked to the NSA revelations from Edward Snowden. And I want to just give a shout out and a thank you to Edward Snowden for coming forward and being a whistleblower.
More on that in a second, but go ahead.
Yes, Edward Snowden's revelations of NSA and CIA data collection from the Bull Run program to the PRISM program and all the other secret programs that it turns out were often secret even from congressional intelligence committees and from the FISA court, who sometimes found out about some of these activities after the fact. And had to approve them after the fact, to some of the revelations, including the tech company complicity in the spying scandals, from Microsoft giving NSA pre-encryption stage access to email on Outlook.com and Hotmail, to giving FBI access to SkyDrive, its online storage service, to Yahoo and Google and other companies receiving payments from the NSA for providing information to them, to the revelation of the CIA's black budget, which has doubled in the past decade. This past year alone, the CIA's budget was almost $15 billion spent on things like secret prisons, torture programs, drones, and its enormous, enormous and growing counterterrorism center. I just want to say again, thank you, Edward Snowden, for opening the door for us to all of that great information.
And I would say also, as of an underreported story, the fact that, you know, Snowden was portrayed when this first hit earlier this year as a terrorist, as somebody who committed treason, as somebody who, according to many public officials, should be executed. Mind you, hadn't been charged, let alone tried for anything yet. Yeah. And yet he's been vindicated over the past several months, and we've had media story after media story that has documented that vindication, and yet the paradigm of Snowden as this threat to national security remains unchallenged in national media, and that too has been underreported.
Yeah.
I had a couple remaining ones as we wrap up here. One, and this is a very large story that didn't get nearly the importance that it should have. The Supreme Court last June gutting the Voting Rights Act, and doing so in the face of a concerted effort in virtually every state that is currently covered by the Voting Rights Act to deny minorities the right to vote, and deny, for that matter, anybody who regularly, in their perception, votes Democratic, whether it be non-white voters or students or the elderly or whomever, making it more difficult for all of those folks to vote. And yet, in the face of that, the Supreme Court deciding, nope, you don't have to worry about any of that anymore. Very, very disturbing for the future of democracy in this country. And then one last one, which is that we have a de facto abortion ban now in much of the United States, despite the fact that Roe v. Wade is still on the books. At the state level, we've gotten more and more radical laws continuing to be passed and continuing to be upheld in a lot of the courts. Everything from bans starting at 15 to 20 weeks to requiring hospital admitting privileges in states where no hospitals will issue admitting privileges to doctors who perform reproductive health care, to the loss of incest and rape exemptions being no longer a fringe part of anti-abortion legislation, but now mainstream Republican Party dogma, accompanied, of course, by a lot of excuse making for people who rape, and criticism of victims of rape, and can criticism of 6-year-old victims of incest be far behind? Very, very disturbing trend, hardly ever portrayed as a trend in national media.
And then at the bottom of my list, came last not because it is least important, but because it was later in the year, was the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, the main feature of the Affordable Care Act, which is healthcare.gov. And what was most underreported about that was the huge demand for insurance coverage on not just the federal exchange, but all the state exchanges completely swamped, even the ones that were well designed in places like California, New York, and here in Washington State. That took, I think, just about everybody by surprise, except for those of us who know people who have been struggling to get health care coverage for decades in this country. Also, and as a part of the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, the unreported crime of Republican governors in about half of all U.S. states refusing to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, which is leaving millions of poor people without any health care coverage at all at a time when it should be easier for them to get it than ever.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with you this day. Do we have any events? I didn't check.
No events this week. Can we talk a little bit about the NSA ruling when the minute we have left?
Yes, if you can do it in 30 seconds.
Okay, yeah. Federal judge ruling Monday that the NSA's bulk collection of phone records violates the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution and its ban on unreasonable searches, but, of course, put his decision on hold pending the inevitable government appeal. You've had several other district courts that have ruled the opposite way, and this is almost so certainly going to go to the Supreme Court, but it was a George W. Bush appointee, and his opinion, quote, "I cannot imagine a more indiscriminate and arbitrary invasion than a systematic and high-tech collection and retention of personal data on virtually every single citizen. Surely such a program infringes on that degree of privacy that the founders enshrined in the Fourth Amendment," end quote.
All right. Good quote to end on.
Yeah.
Talking with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.